owe them, but very few of us know them. They took an oath to protect us at home and abroad, so the rest of us can live safe and free. They are the men and women of our military and first responder communities, and these are their stories. American Warrior Radio is on the air.
Welcome to American Warrior Radio, ladies and gentlemen. This is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. It has been said there are no atheists in foxholes. Now, while the original source of this statement is uncertain, it doesn't explicitly refer to the higher religious conversion rate under fire, but rather the concept that in times of extreme stress or fear, persons naturally hope for the kind intervention of a higher power. I've never been in the military, so I cannot attest to the truthfulness of this statement. However, given the background of our guest today, I can say with great confidence that, in this case, there was no atheist in the cockpit. Derek Jones is a combat veteran fighter pilot with more than 3,000 hours in the F-111 and F-16 aircraft. During his time in the Air Force, he won numerous Top Gun awards. He was one of the last Top Gun winners in the F-111 before the aircraft was retired in 1996. Derek was also wing Top Gun for the 27th Fighter Wing while flying F-16s. Derek retired from the Air Force at the rank of colonel in 2009. Before that, in 2001, he was ordained into the Anglican Church of North America and was consecrated a bishop in 2007. He is the first bishop of the Armed Forces and Chaplaincy for the jurisdiction of the Armed Forces and Chaplaincy. And I don't know how to properly introduce him, so let's see if I can cover all the bases. Welcome to American Warrior Radio, Colonel, the Right Reverend Bishop Derek Jones. Derek, how did I do?
Oh, you did all right, but DJ will just do just fine.
DJ, okay. Well, we'll see. I'll go back and forth. What a pleasure to have you on, sir. We've been sort of trading phone calls for a while now. It's great to have you on. Here, right around the Lenten season, I think is certainly appropriate.
It is. This is the beginning of Lent, Ash Wednesday, just this past Wednesday, and we're now in the Lenten season. So a penitential rite for you to have me on.
Oh, this is going to go well, I can tell. So, DJ, based on your birthday, we graduated high school the same year, but when I talked to the Air Force recruiter, he said, son, you are not a future Top Gun. your path was a little bit different, wasn't it?
It was. I grew up in a rather prolific and kind of military-connected family. And so progression into the military was almost a birthright for me in some respects, but not the direction I was initially going when I went into college. But it is, in fact. My father was actually, back when the Air Force became a separate service, had been recruited to help begin the military music program. Back in that day, you had one or two networks, and the military service bands were probably the best PR that the military services had as far as engaging with community. And so my father was one who helped start the Air Force Singing Sergeants. He was the its first director of the sergeants, and then did a radio program called Serenade in Blue that was, across the nation, syndicated across the nation, and Colonel Howard, the first director of the Air Force Band. But then by an act of Congress, he ended up, because of inter-service jealousy, ended up becoming the first moderator and soloist for the United States Marine Corps Band. So I had a lot of military exposure. On top of that, his cousin ended up being Bill Fitch. For those who are Marine Corps out there, they're going to know who Bill Fitch is, probably one of the most decorated. He is undoubtedly the most decorated aviation combat veteran for the Marine Corps, who died just a couple years ago. He's actually my cousin. So I had a lot of military influence growing up, and so it was kind of a natural walk for me.
Now, I think, DJ, you and I have a friend in common, Robin Rand.
We do.
Where did you two cross paths?
I got to tell you, I don't remember. you meet somebody and they just become part of your kind of the woven fabric of people, I don't remember the first time I met him, but yes. And I also thought you were going to mention Christina. Christina is my admin assistant, Christiana Benson. Who was part of a youth group that my wife and I led when I was at RAF Upper Hayford. Christina will be glad that I got her name mixed up with Christiana. Christiana is a much dearer friend to
well,
me, but anyway.
Our listeners yeah. know that Christiana is our national partnership manager for American Warrior Radio, so very hard worker, and she's the one that put us in touch, and I'm very, very glad she did. DJ, let's talk a little bit. I mentioned that you flew both the F-111 and the F-16. Did you fly both of those in combat, one or the other?
I actually have combat time in both aircraft, yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Tell us a little bit about, and, you know, Robin, General Rand is an F-16, a Lawn Dart pilot, if I may take that liberty. But
you can say that.
Okay. I got to tell you, the Aardvark is one of my favorite aircraft ever. I mean, she looks mean just sitting on the tarmac. Tell us more. In Tucson, people are probably very familiar with the F-16. We've got the largest Air National Guard fighter wing, I believe, in the country, flies out of Tucson International, but not so familiar with the F-111. Tell us a little bit about that aircraft.
Well, the F-111 was actually back when Robert McNamara was the supporting, was working defense issues and helping with directing, kind of. It was his baby. The F-111 was a precursor, actually a derivative of the F-111 is the F-14 Tomcat for the United States mm-hmm. Navy. Both of these aircraft now are retired, but it was the first variable sweep wing fighter aircraft developed. And it was designed because the folks looking into the future thought that the world of fighter aircraft were going to be supersonic, right? And that fighting was going to be supersonic. All of these folks didn't realize that, in fact, turn radius has everything to do with being a fighter pilot, and the F-111 was not going to outturn anybody when it's going supersonic. But I will tell you, it was a remarkable airplane once it morphed into its mission, also known as Whispering Death. In Vietnam, it just had an incredible high success rate in both its strike capability. It was the first aircraft to incorporate what was known as terrain following radar, or TFR, where it could fly unaided in the dark, in the weather, using radar systems only 200 feet off the ground, strike with great precision and be out before anybody knew it was there. So it was not surprising that when it came time for the Libyan raid in 1987, that the F-111 was the aircraft used to do that strike on Libya back in 1987.
Now we'll come back to the F-14 a little bit later in the show, but the F-111, that's two crew, correct?
Yeah, it is two. It was a pilot whose primary job was to keep the airplane from hitting the ground. And the WISO, or the Weapons System Officer, and F-111 also had EWOs, Electronic Warfare Officers, who also would sit in the right seat. But the Weapons System Officer, his primary duty back in the ancient days of early radar, was to decipher what he was looking at on the scope and make sure the correct targets were being picked up. That was his primary duty. Electronic warfare officers actually know beeps and squeaks of what the enemy, you know, a radar system and what it sounds like through a particular receptor, and would often fly in the 111, because the 111 also had a very good self-protection package against surface-to-air threats. And, of course, the EF-111, yet another derivative of the airplane, was the first supersonic aircraft that could be embedded and could use electronic warfare as well. So it was a great platform. In fact, the Australians flew it up until about 10 years ago as well. We retired the airplanes. We retired the airplane back fully back in the early 1990s. The last fighter squadrons being in the 80s, but the Australians continued to fly the F-111 for quite some time.
Well, DJ, I want to apologize to our listeners in Phoenix. I've overlooked the fact that Luke Air Force Base, I think, is the largest fighter wing in the country right now, active duty there now, the training base for the F-35. So my producer, Tom, who's kind of an Air Force fan, he was mentioning the F-111 was a pretty nice, smooth, comfortable ride. I mean, relative to supersonic, I'm guessing.
Yeah, I mean, one of the other things pretty unique about it was that rather than having an ejection seat, it had an ejection capsule. Because of the speeds at which it could fly, you couldn't actually bail out of the aircraft and be exposed to the wind. So if you ever had to separate or had reason that you had your aircraft became disabled and had to eject, the entire capsule would leave the aircraft, and then the entire capsule would come down underneath a chute, which was great because it would allow the crew to get their story straight on the way down.
Not that you ever needed that, did you?
Not that we never ever needed that.
Yeah, there you go. Ladies and gentlemen, this is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. We're joined by DJ, or more formally known as the Bishop, Derek Jones. He is a Top Gun pilot in the Air Force. He's also the Bishop of the Armed Forces and Chaplaincy. We'll be right back after these messages. Stick around. Welcome back to American Warrior Radio, ladies and gentlemen. This is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. I'm not going to say I'm sitting in the cockpit today. I guess I'm sitting in the capsule because we're talking with a Top Gun F-111 and F-16 pilot who also happens to be a bishop, Derek Jones. Derek, what a great – I can tell this is one of those shows that's going to go by real quick. I kind of teased the F-16 and the fact that you are a Top Gun pilot. Tom Cruise – recently promoted they're filming a new Top Gun sequel. He promoted the movie by tweeting a photo of his Maverick character superimposed over the image of an F-18 Hornet. The Air Force replied with a tweet, "If Maverick really had a need for speed, he could hop in one of our F-15E Strike Eagles. They have a top speed of 1,875 miles per hour." Now, for the folks who don't know that, the F-15 Tomcat in the original Top Gun movies had his top speed of around 1,500 miles per hour. Well, of course, the Navy had to get in on the action. They replied by tweeting their signature line for the movie, "Remember, boys, no points for second place." This apparently caused some heads at the Air Force to explode, and they tweeted back, "The F-15 knows nothing about this quote-unquote second place you speak of. Check the scoreboard, hashtag undefeated." DJ, I chose not to insult you by playing the theme from Top Gun because that was Navy. You were Air Force. But tell us a little bit about the Air Force version of Top Gun.
Well, the Air Force version of Top Gun, actually, you need to get General Rand on. He's a former commandant, if I remember, the Fighter Weapons School. The Air Force version is, in fact, the Fighter Weapons Instructor Course, or FWIC, or FWIC. Graduates, individuals that go to that training course for the Air Force, basically receive essentially a master's degree in weaponry. They are among the very best and the very brightest and the very smartest fighter pilots and weaponeers that the Air Force has. I can honestly say that's probably why I didn't ever go to the school. But Robin Rand, of course, he not only went to the school. In fact, I think that's about the time I first met him, was he was at the weapons school. Most of my time with him has been when he was doing legislative affairs for the Secretary of the Air Force, when I had just retired and was working with the National Conference on Ministry of the Armed Forces. So most of my interactions with him have been after that. But the fighter weapons course itself, each of these fighter squadrons would then have two or three what we call weaponeers, individuals who have the ability to understand munitions, understand their effects, understand how they're going to be engaged either in an air-to-air or in an air-to-ground situation. And that's kind of the focus. For all that the Navy movie Top Gun might have done, I just simply remind the Navy that the Air Force was given the first opportunity by the producers of the movie, and the Air Force turned it down because we were too busy. So the Navy obviously had some extra time on their hands with some spare part aircraft to try to get it done. I'm only serious, by the way. Don't take me kiddingly.
For any Navy Top Gun pilots out there listening, you will have more time. Send me an email, bbg@americanwarriorradio.com. We'll give you a chance to reply. So, DJ, I'm not very smart, so I get confused. So are we talking about Red Flag or William Tell or both or neither?
Well, Red Flag, Maple Flag, William Tell, all of those type of exercises are where the graduates of the school take going and getting a school education is really nice, and it's a nice resume builder for you, but it does nothing for our warfighting capability unless those men have and women have the opportunity to share their knowledge with full units. And so exercises such as Red Flag, which, by the way, I want to get off the inter-service rivalry here, I understand that a lot of what we do in this day and age is very purple. It's not blue, it's not green, it's not navy, it's purple. It's mm-hmm. It's a common effort. And so you'll have Navy, Marine Corps, foreign fighters and everything out at Red Flag exercises. And the Fighter Weapons School out there plays a large part in Red Flag exercises quite often, as well as the aggressor squadrons. But that's where those that have gone to the school then can convey to their squadron mates and to others the opportunity for all fighter pilots to see the effective musicians, to operate jointly, to learn how to know and learn how to engage aircraft in modern warfare. And as many people know, the Air Force has been in conflict now for nearly the last 25 years, have been engaged nonstop. Other services have had some breaks in and out, but those exercises help keep fleeting skills honed to their very best, which is why we've got the best military, particularly both Air Force, Navy, and Marine Corps, best flying fighters and attack pilots in the world, period, dot. No question.
Well, I think this last year, Red Flag had over 95 aircraft. You mentioned, obviously, we're there, the Royal Air Force, and I think the Royal Australian Air Force are also regular participants.
They are. They are regular participants. There's a whole generation now that's now coming in, many of whom who do not have combat time. Of course, what was good for me was as I was coming up, and others from my generation, we had Vietnam veterans and POWs and others. In fact, Senator McCain and I had become friends, there's just a whole host of mentoring that would go on from folks. And we now have that next generation of folks being able to pass on their experiences from the Gulf, from the post-Gulf, from Afghanistan, and others, other places, to those who have not yet seen combat. And the safest place and the only place to be able to do that is at our Red Flag exercises and things of that nature. Given the money crunch or the dollar crunches from the previous 8 years, those exercises become even more important because the dollars are being so squeezed, there's fewer opportunities. And we know that can be a detriment to training. I could keep talking about this. But we can't lose those type of exercises. I'm very excited to learn that the military now is looking at contracting what we call red air or the enemy air. Mm-hmm. And we've got multiple companies out there now with varying types of aircraft, that makes the program even better. Because we get seasoned fighter pilots hopping in the cockpit of these aircraft that take not only their knowledge and experience, but also their ability to learn the skill sets and practices of foreign nations that we might come in conflict with, and our guys get to train against those type of tactics. It's just an invaluable opportunity.
DJ, what aircraft do the aggressor squadrons fly? Do they fly all types of brands, or they fly just one particular kind of aircraft?
They used to just fly one particular type, but now they fly all different brands of aircraft. We've got several companies out there, and in fact, that's one of the newest things coming around the corner for the Air Force is letting out not just one or two contracts, but multiple contracts to multiple companies who can provide everything from Kafirs to MiGs to just every imaginable foreign aircraft that's out there right now.
Amazing. Now, so explain to me again, because again, I'm not that bright, Bishop, but
sure.
How did you, what did you need to do to be able to call yourself a Top Gun?
Well, in the Air Force, Top Guns tend to be awards based upon quarterly or yearly performance.
Okay.
And generally speaking, in the F-111, it was a primary air-to-ground mission. And so if you ended the year with the best bomb scores of everyone else, you were declared the Top Gun. And I've been very blessed, Ben. For whatever reason, God has shown favor on me through my military career. I was able to graduate in the top 10% of my pilot training class and have been a distinguished graduate from most of my classes. And I'm gonna tell folks out there, it's not from looking for Pokemons or whatever you do nowadays with your phone. It's from hard work and dedication and study and being adaptable to your surroundings and understanding what your responsibilities are. But I've been blessed to be able to have been a distinguished graduate out of fighter lead-in school, out of my replacement training unit. I was received my first Top Gun award graduating from F-111 school. I also got the Top Gun award graduating out of F-16 school. And then over the years in the F-111, I had two wing Top Gun awards, one with the 20th Fighter Wing in England and one with the 27th Fighter Wing. The one with the 27th Fighter Wing is most special to me because, to my knowledge, it was the last time they gave out a Top Gun award before they retired the aircraft. So no one's told me for certain, but I suspect I was the last wing Top Gun on the F-111 before the aircraft retired. And I was actually on staff at 8th Air Force when that happened. And then in the F-16, I went back to Cannon Air Force Base again and received the wing Top Gun award there once, and then several squadron Top Gun awards. So the difference is the Navy calls it a school. The Air Force is a little bit more focused on making sure what's important, the graduation certificate, and your knowledge is a whole lot more. And so it's called Fighter Weapons School. I am not a Fighter Weapons School graduate, though I certainly would not have minded going, but that was not necessarily my career path. My career path was primarily in safety and doing mishap investigations. That would be the difference.
DJ, when we come back, we're going to switch altitudes a little bit. I know in the Air Force, sometimes you call the altitude, you call it into angels and whatever the number is. Your next step in your career, you're spending time with some different angels. Before we do that, though, just a quick historical question coming back to the F-111. Did McNamara want that aircraft for both the Navy and the Air Force, and the Navy said, no, we want our own, and that's how we ended up with Tomcats?
He did.
Okay.
He did. He McNamara and the Whiz Kids all believed that the F-111 was going to be the solution to every possible air combat engagement problem ever. Unfortunately, they were just ill-informed at the time. The aircraft itself became the best and was the best at what its mission was, which was deep strike, deep penetration. I mean, for those who don't know, the wall came down in Germany. The F-111's part in that, because of the long-range reach into the Soviet Union that was being practiced every day by RAF Upper Hayford and RAF Lakenheath at the time flying F-111s, the threat was very real to the Soviets. And so McNamara thought it was going to be the plane to end all planes. He just, unfortunately, he just didn't quite understand flying operations like pilots do.
Funny how that works. Ladies and gentlemen, this is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. We're joined by Derek Jones. Derek Jones is a Top Gun pilot and is also a bishop. We'll be right back. Welcome back to American Warrior Radio, ladies and gentlemen. This is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. We're looking to expand our messages here on American Warrior Radio into other markets. If you'd like to help out, visit patreon.com, patreon.com/AmericanWarriorRadio For just around a cup of coffee a month, you can cool yourself, score yourself some very cool swag, like one of those custom American Warrior Radio bottle breachers. We're joined by Derek Jones, Colonel Derek Jones, Bishop Derek Jones. Derek, some of my favorite historical pilots were members of the World War II Eagle Squadrons. These were Americans, U.S. citizens who volunteered to fly for the RAF before the U.S. entered the war. Some of them become part of the 4th Fighter Group flying out of England. One of their commanders, who's an ace with 14 and a half aerial victories, was a fellow by the name of Howard Hively. His call sign was Deacon. You, in going through your bio, DJ, you were ordained in 2001 but didn't retire from the Air Force until 2009. So the question for you is, was your call sign Bishop?
No, it wasn't. Actually, yeah, not quite. And wanting to keep the radio program clean, most nicknames for fighter guys, you have the public meaning and you have the private meaning. We don't let people know what the private meaning actually was, and those were and you just have the public explanation of what your nickname was. Mine, DJ. If you carry a call sign into combat, then you're forever allowed to keep that call sign. And
okay. So
fortunately for me, I had a couple of previous call signs that weren't probably quite as flattering. But
let's stick with DJ. It is a family show.
We'll just stick with DJ. Yeah, it is a family show.
So tell me about that point, though, in your life. You were a fighter pilot, but you decided to join the ministry. And I guess one of the things that struck me, and part of the reason I wanted to have you on, one of the best interviews I've ever done that I really enjoyed was a gentleman who was involved with Army Ranger Jeff Strucker. He was involved in the Black Hawk Down, mm-hmm. the Battle of Mogadishu. That
yes,
experience,
I'm aware.
Yeah, he inspired him to become an ordained minister, return to lead the Rangers as a chaplain in combat. What was your progression there, DJ? How did you embark on this path?
Well, frankly, it starts in my parents were most definitely the most influential people in my life, but I had the opportunity to work for SeaWorld was a performer with Disney, musician. I mean, I had a lot of opportunities ahead of me, but my minister of youth at my small church in Kissimmee, Florida, First Baptist Church of Kissimmee, his name was Bill Pedrick. He died this past year, served as really a great mentor to me. But as I began to enter and go into the military, made the decision to change my major from music to mathematics, and pursue a flying career. One of the things that he said to me was that you don't wear your Christianity on Sunday. It's something that you have to wear all the time. And so I became very adept, quite frankly, to looking like and walking like a Christian, though I'm not sure that my life was really truly reflective, that my heart was really truly reflective. And while this isn't a religious radio program, it's a part you're asking a part of me. And so that's kind of where it lies. And I ended up going through a very difficult time losing my older brother to a mosquito bite, viral encephalitis and dying. My mother passing away, my father passing away. And really the strongest person by my side was my wife. Connie, never faltered in trying to keep me focused on Christ in just in our daily walk and everything else. And we ended up deploying we were in Saudi Arabia at Prince Sultan Air Base, and we were flying combat missions up into the Baghdad area and that sort of thing. And Promise Keepers had become a rather big group. And one of my dear friends and colleagues in the S-16, Chad Krusty Crawford, he said, "Hey, DJ, will you come speak to a group of guys about your testimony?" And, of course, it was kind of fresh in my mind, having just lost my brother and everything, and kind of my conversion and coming back to the church and to Christ in a more real way since my time as a high school youth. And I went, and there was just a handful of folks there, and I shared my testimony. And lo and behold, several folks decided they wanted to, follow and become a Christian. Chad Krusty asked me if I'd do it again a second night, and they had a few more people there. And then a week went by, and he says, "Will you do it one more time for us?" And when we did, I walked into a room that had probably 100 folks in it, all wanting to hear about, you know, a fighter pilot who's a Christian. In fact, I had one friend who was in the fighter squadron with us show up, and I said, "I can't believe you came to this." He says, "I just want to see if you can talk for 30 minutes without saying a cuss word." And so at that event,
and did you?
Someone came up. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Oh no, I did. I was able to.
Okay.
Well, never mind. I was about to make an off-color joke, but I won't.
Yeah.
At that time, my wife and I were discussing whether I should get off of active duty and pursue ministry. And we were very close to, I was very close to becoming in the end game of a military retirement at that time. So it was a difficult decision, but I elected to get off of active duty and go to seminary. At the time, there was a fighter pilot shortage, so the Air Force exercised an option to keep me on active duty 6 months longer than I wanted to. Lest I would have been flying with an F-16 Guard unit, I ended up going and flying as an instructor pilot at Columbus Air Force Base in Mississippi, is what we call a graybeard, with a reserve unit, and went to school. And during that time, found myself returning to somewhat of my Episcopal roots, my Episcopal church roots, early from my early life, being sacramental in a manner. But I would fly Monday, Wednesday, Friday for the reserve, and then go to school Tuesday, Thursday. Mm-hmm. Or just the opposite, would go fly Tuesday, Thursday in a weekend cross country and then go to school Monday, Wednesday, Friday. Mm-hmm. And during that time, I was contacted and made direction back towards the Anglican Church, and was asked if I would consider becoming an endorser for the Anglican Church. And I can explain what an endorser is here later. If you'd like me to go there, I can. But
well,
essentially,
let's talk about, because I didn't know that there was a bishop of the armed forces until Christiana made the introduction. Tell us, so let me back up. So in your bio, it says you were the founding bishop. Does that mean that this whole thing was kind of your idea, you pushed for it, or?
Well, I wouldn't say it was my idea. I would say that my timing was exceptionally good. I mean, what greater comedy of God is there to put a fighter pilot in charge of a bunch of chaplains? What was taking place during that time was within the Episcopal Church. There was the beginning of a mass exodus because of some of the social issues going on that were of a moral issue that were kind of invading the Episcopal Church. And so you had what was being founded, or the groundwork for what is now the Anglican Church. So both are part of the worldwide Anglican Communion. But the Episcopal Church, following a more progressive and somewhat liberal interpretation of Scripture, and the Anglican Church, following a more orthodox and historical view of Scripture. And so there were a lot of chaplains that were wanting to leave the Episcopal Church or who had views that were associated, that were far more orthodox, and they needed an endorser. They needed someone that could kind of give oversight. And my last job on active duty was as the director of staff at the Air Force Doctrine Center, where I was also the reserve advisor. And one of the last publications that I worked on was a purple publication called JP-105, which is the Joint Publication for Religious Affairs. It's basically how the military services engage faith and religious activity towards the military readiness of its soldiers, sailors, airmen, and Marines,
and
guardsmen.
We could do a whole three other shows on that.
Before
we get into, I want to talk to you a little bit about that, particularly in the context of today's modern warrior, DJ. But what? So, as the Bishop of the Armed Forces and the chaplaincy, what is your role? Reader's Digest version, what do you do? What is your function?
I train, educate, and credential those chaplains who will be representing the Anglican Church in their faith as chaplains in the United States military.
And
it's that simple.
And I find it interesting, you also work, though, or you're responsible for the VA, chaplains of the Department of Justice, even police chaplains, correct?
That's correct. You have two types of chaplains out there, and I'm sorry to say this, and this will be offensive to some listeners, I'm sure, but you have professional chaplains. Those, if I were to equate it to the medical profession, where your doctors, or excuse me, where your neurosurgeons, your doctors are like your rectors of churches and that sort of thing, your general practitioners. Chaplains are like your neurosurgeons and your orthopedic doctors and your psychiatrists. They're the specialized above just a general medical degree. They have a sophisticated and advanced learning in engaging within a narrowly defined spectrum of responsibility of religious engagement and quite frankly, spiritual triage. And those professional chaplains generally are working in areas where, like the government, they're not in the religion business, so they rely upon the various faith groups out there to say, tell me who is qualified to work for us.
Mm-hmm.
And so every military chaplain has two bosses. They have their military boss, whom they answer to, and they have their ecclesiastical boss, whom they answer to. And the two, either one can terminate that chaplain's employment.
Wow.
In the military or in the VA. And so when you're talking about military chaplains, when you're talking about VA chaplains, when you're talking about law enforcement chaplains, even some community and hospice chaplains, they all have beyond their seminary degrees and any church experience they might have, they have advanced education, which, you know, in some cases, if it were an accredited university program, they'd be doctorates.
Mm-hmm.
But in fact, they're just simply advanced certifications. And so as an endorser, and I for the Anglican Church and the government right now, the military and VA recognize 198 different faith groups out there. You've got your Southern Baptist, Northern Baptist, Anabaptist. You've got every version of Islam. You've got every mm-hmm. You've got Buddhists. You've got all of those faith groups all together. All of those faith groups have one person, one signatory for that faith group that says this person can be a chaplain for you.
DJ,
and that's the role that I play for the Anglican Church.
DJ, when we come back, I want to kind of drill down a little bit more into that and what sort of the practical ramifications are for a
sure.
chaplain and the members of our armed services. And I'm glad you mentioned it. I did some research this morning. Department of Defense, I think the number is now up to 221 denominations.
That's not right.
Or affiliations, 13 of which are Presbyterian, which is what I am. I didn't know there was 13 Presbyterian faiths out there, but it's okay. We'll get over it. Folks, your host, Ben Bueller Garcia, very pleased to be joined by Bishop Derek Jones. He's a retired Air Force colonel as well. We're going to talk a little bit more about atheists in foxholes or cockpits when we come back. Welcome back to American Warrior Radio, ladies and gentlemen. This is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. We're joined by Bishop Derek Jones. He is the Bishop of the Armed Forces and Chaplaincy for the Anglican Church. Is it or in North America? Forgive me.
In North America.
In North America.
Anglican Church in North America, yes.
And DJ, I want to emphasize this for our listeners, too, because I tell you, one of my experiences mm-hmm. when I was the honorary commander for our friend General Robin Rand was we were at another Air Force base doing a change of command, and it was a reserve squadron. And I got to tell you, the first sergeant they had up there on the stage was not in any way close to being fit, and it showed. I mean, literally, you know, like his buttons were pulling open on his blouse. And I'll tell you mm-hmm. what, the command chief had a chat with that commander there immediately after that service, and I think that got taken care of. But I want to emphasize again that what you talked about is these chaplains are in the armed forces. These are highly trained, in most cases, bachelor's, master's, maybe even the equivalent of a doctorate. They still have to meet the physical standards and other requirements to be a commissioned officer.
That's correct.
Okay.
For my particular faith group, 70% either already have or are working on doctorate degrees. All chaplains have master's degree, and there are 92-hour master degrees. So they, you know, the time spent is the equivalent of a doctorate in most places. And chaplains have to, they with the Army, they are embedded. With the Marine Corps, they are embedded with combat troops. If they can't keep up, then they don't go. Several of my chaplains have jump wings. Many have been through Ranger School. Special Forces, I've got chaplains in Black Ops with Special Forces. So these are not, you know, these are not your Sunday preachers at the pulpit kind of people. These are highly skilled, highly physically fit, highly engaged and professional men and women serving our armed forces.
The chaplains, if I'm not mistaken, DJ, were established by the Continental Congress way back in 1775 with our Army. Things have changed quite a bit since then. I saw some data that I don't know if it's, you know, we mentioned 221 religious preference options right now under the Department of Defense. My understanding is up to 20 to 25% of the men and women entering our military now have claimed no religious affiliation. What kind of challenges do you see that brings to someone of faith or not in a very regimented, structured system like the U.S. Armed Forces?
Yeah, call me cynical. One of the organizations that I'm currently the chair of is the National Conference on Ministry to the Armed Forces. And in fact, if anybody has any takeaways from this radio program, I would encourage you to look at what this organization does. This is the peer organization of all endorsers. And the National Conference on Ministry of the Armed Forces, sitting next to me on my right might be a Unitarian Universalist. On my left might be an Orthodox Jew. And the spectrum of beliefs and the spectrum of theological understanding and engagement is vast. It's much broader and deeper than even our political system, and we're all able to get along. I know this isn't a political program, but I just wanted to point that out.
Okay,
that's
fair. Absolutely. We kind of joke. I'm Presbyterian. There's the left-handed Presbyterians, the Saturday Presbyterians, the red-headed Presbyterians. It's like, but you know what? We're all Christians at the end of the day. And I'm curious. Well, we've got just about 4 minutes left, so there's something I want to run by you. One thing that's different now, I believe, particularly in these current conflicts, given what has spurred the attacks, I read a phrase called religious situational awareness, and the idea now that from a tactical standpoint that religion is playing. I mean, as I understand it, there's general orders where if you're a non-believer, you're not even allowed to enter into a mosque. And I get that, but war is war.
Yeah. The issue right now that we're experiencing with nuns, or what we call the nuns, no religious preference, is being touted as a way to try to remove religion from our military system. Understand how the military goes, the rest of society goes. And that's always been the case. And that's why it's being attacked. In reality, the majority of these nuns actually do have faith. And they have faith practices. What they are saying is that they don't necessarily identify with one particular faith group, but we statistically know there's tons of stuff out there. Barna recently did a study, and others. The spiritual fitness of a soldier, sailor, airman, marine is as important as their physical fitness when they prepare to engage in combat. While there are some that are of no faith, we actually discovered through Barna that nearly 70% of all people getting prepared to go to war will actually pick up scripture. They'll pick up a Bible. I suspect that the other 30% are just because they didn't have one available. No one goes into something that is bigger than them without knowing that there's a power and authority that is bigger than all of it. That's something that they all want. And so this whole idea of eliminating spirituality, that's the reason why the Navy, the Air Force, and the Army have all said, hey, we cut back our number of chaplains too few over the last few years. We've got to bolster them back up because they have discovered it is a far more efficient and effective fighting force when a chaplain and when faith is incorporated into their readiness. And so whether that faith is Christian or Muslim, as long as it's sincerely held and can be honed and secured for the warrior, then the warrior has a better chance of success.
And DJ, I'm glad you, in that last phrase there, you answered, at least for me, the question about whether there's atheists in foxholes. And I got to tell you, I know in the Middle Ages when warriors would come back from battle, they would have to do penance to make up for the horror, the things that they did in war, whether it was a just war or not. And I can't imagine my religion, my personal faith, killing's a bad thing. And I can imagine sometimes if you have to do that, that having someone like a chaplain of whatever faith around would make a big difference for me personally. We got 10 seconds, 15 seconds. DJ, any last thoughts?
No, Ben, thanks for having me on the program. I certainly enjoyed it. I'm afraid I may have talked too much. There could have been so much more we could have unpacked.
You know what?
But I appreciate the opportunity.
We'll schedule to come back because, honestly, there's a lot of other things I want to explore, some thoughts that Sebastian Junger planted in my head. So, DJ, thank you for your service on both fronts, both the military and spiritual. Ladies and gentlemen, what a great show. You can find out more at AmericanWarriorRadio.com. Do me a favor, spread the word. Over 180 interviews with heroes just like DJ out there. Spread the word, please. Until next time, ladies and gentlemen, this has been your host. All policies and procedures are remain in place. Take care.
You've been listening to American Warrior Radio. You can hear over 150 episodes of this program at AmericanWarriorRadio.com.